When you wonder, you're learning. Mr. Rogers' Enduring Lessons for Raising Creative, Curious, Caring Kids by Greg Bear and Ryan Rydelsky. Chapter 2, Mud Pies and Block Buildings, Creativity. The piano plays a familiar tune, the famous front door swings open, and there's Mr. Rogers, smiling, clad in blue pants and a blue dress shirt, and soon a blue cardigan sweater. He sits down on a blue cushion and ties his blue canvas shoes. Behind him, the blue wall of his TV living room meets with his blue TV window. It's a beautiful TV day, and Rogers wants to tell you something. I just never knew there were so many different kinds of spoons. Yes, spoons. He holds up a handful and debuts them one by one, giving the camera a close-up of each. Look, here's a teaspoon. Here's one that looks like a teaspoon, but actually it's for grapefruits. Here's a sugar spoon, a serving spoon, a spoon for ladling gravy, and a spoon that's very old. So many different spoons with different functions and stories. Do you ever use spoons to dig? And did you know that sometimes moms and dads have very fancy spoons? And do you ever wonder where spoons come from? Before you can answer, indeed, before you can question the point of all of this, Rogers makes his way to picture-picture, the picture-frame-turned-television that hangs on his wall, and starts a documentary. It's a film about, you guessed it, how people make spoons. Look how slowly he works, says Rogers, set to a gentle jazzy soundtrack. The film shows an artist drawing pictures and making models and bringing new spoons into being. Both men and women design spoons, Rogers reminds us. We watch machines churn out prototypes, workers make revisions and refinements, and inspectors in pursuit of perfection. Spoons, says Rogers, spoons, so many spoons. It's very interesting, isn't it? It sure is. The documentary ends, but Rogers is just getting started. He's got a friend, you see, with a special spoon talent, one you're really going to like. She's coming by a little later, so we'll have to wait a while first. And while we wait, we'll let our minds wander and we'll start to daydream. We'll start to make believe. Let's think of something that would have spoons in the story, said Roger. Spoons and the king and Lady Aberlin. And, well, let's just make it up together. Spoons, the king, and Lady Aberlin. Let's make it up together. It sounds like the start of an improv skit. Fuse these nouns by constructing a story. Use your imagination. Be creative. For most of Roger's audience, such a directive would pose no trouble. Any friend of a five-year-old knows how quickly kids can spin a story. In fact, among young children, creativity is almost universal. In 1968, Dr. George Land tested the creative potential of more than 1,000 five-year-olds using a test he developed for NASA. A full 98% scored so high that they qualified as creative geniuses. The implication is that human beings are born creative. Though genes and heredity have been found to play a part, nearly all of us are gifted with at least some ability to imagine new solutions to problems, whether we're generating lists of novel ideas, an ability called divergent thinking, or drawing from diverse interdisciplinary fields, convergent thinking. Every child is born with a unique endowment, which gives him an opportunity to make something entirely different from everybody else in the world, Rogers once said. You see it when you watch children at their own play. There are no two mud pies the same. Block buildings have infinite variety. The advantages of such an endowment can't be overstated. Researchers have found that the more creative an animal species is, the more likely it is to survive when introduced to a new situation, new environments, and new threats. In the Tohoku region of northern Japan, for example, a species of crow drops walnuts near slow-moving cars. The cars run over the walnuts, cracking them open, and the crows sweep in to eat. Their creativity has turned the region's abundant walnut groves into a steady source of food. No wonder we revere it so much. Barack Obama once called creativity the country's single greatest asset. Nearly every celebrity we adore is a creative professional. And in 2019, LinkedIn, the world's largest job network, declared creativity the most in-demand skill on the planet. So why is it that so many adults don't feel particularly creative? Why is it that we're novelists or actors or painters, we tend to regard creativity as a mystery? Something reserved for the Toni Morrisons and Bob Dylans and Gabriel Garcia Marquez's of the world. What happened to all those tiny geniuses from George Land's study? Fortunately, Land stuck around to find out. 5 years after his first experiment, he retested his original subjects who were now 10 years old. This time, the percentage of kids who scored in the highly creative range fell from 98% to 30%. When they turned 15, Land tested them again, and the share of geniuses fell even further to 12%. By the time Land tested the cohort as adults, just 2% had retained their creativity. By Land's measure, the trait ubiquitous among 5-year-olds had, in American adults, become less common than red hair. What we have concluded, wrote Land and his colleagues, is that non-creative behavior is learned. They weren't the first to suggest this. In 1906, the psychologist Theodule Armand Ribot held forth on creativity's demise as only a Frenchman can. The majority of people gradually get lost in the prose of everyday life, bury the dreams of their youth, consider love an illusion, and so forth, he wrote. This, however, is only regression, not an annihilation, because the creative imagination does not disappear completely in anyone. It merely becomes incidental. Creativity, in other words, doesn't simply vanish. It's just that somewhere along the way, we learn to stop indulging it. This has been well documented. Mention the fourth grade slump to researchers and educators, and they'll solemnly nod. There are lots of exceptions, of course, but on average, creativity wanes as kids approach middle school. They stop drawing. They stop making up stories. They set down their instruments and let them gather dust. By adulthood, their music has largely fallen quiet. This is partly due to natural changes in the brain. Young kids are creative not because they have better imaginations than their parents. On the contrary, they have fewer experiences from which they can draw, but because they don't self-censor. Ask a 5-year-old to tell you a tale involving spoons and a fictional puppet king, and she won't worry about whether it's good enough or funny enough or even coherent. She'll just do it. But as kids enter adolescence, a part of the brain called the prefrontal cortex starts to rewire itself. This is where judgment and inhibitions live, and it's where creativity can take a nosedive. The child begins to have a critical attitude towards his own drawing, explains Lev Vygotsky, the legendary Soviet psychologist in 1930. Over time, he comes to the conclusion that he cannot draw, and for this reason, he stops. We also see this curtailment of childish fantasy in the fact that the child loses interest in the naive games of earlier childhood and in fairy tales and fantastic stories. This has its advantages. A childlike lack of restraint would surely wreak havoc on our personal and professional lives, both of which require a certain level of tact. When your boss asks for a progress report, it's probably best to leave out spoons and puppets and make-believes, unless your boss is Mr. Rogers. We develop self-consciousness because our social standing and arguably our survival requires a baseline understanding how others perceive us. But the flip side is that we take our censors too seriously. Because we're so often worried about what other people think, we go out of our way to avoid the humiliation and failure that creative endeavors risk. There's a reason some comedy clubs offer discounts on front row seats. It's the only way they can induce people to sit there and thus risk having to become a part of the show. The more self-conscious we become, the more our creative confidence dwindles. Rogers knew this well. What happens if children hear that their mud pies are no good and their block buildings have no importance? That their paintings and dances and made-up games and songs are of very little value, he once asked. Children, like laboratory rats, can learn quickly not to experiment with wrong answers. Unfortunately, they may be learning this earlier and earlier, scientists say. In the late 1950s, a scholar named E. Paul Torrance developed a series of tests designed to measure creativity. Though far from perfect, the so-called Torrance test became a standard way to gauge divergent thinking, that is, the ability to produce novel, useful solutions to problems. One task, for example, asked kids how they'd improvise a toy truck. In 1958, Torrance tested 400 kids. Scholars tracked the cohort for the next 50 years, recording every patent earned, every business founded, every research paper published, and every grant awarded, according to a 2010 story in Newsweek. What's shocking is how incredibly well Torrance's creativity index predicted those kids' creative accomplishments as adults. Those who came up with more good ideas on Torrance's tasks grew up to be entrepreneurs, inventors, college presidents, authors, doctors, diplomats, and software developers. Subsequent cohorts scored better and better on the Torrance test, suggesting that overall kids were growing more creative over time, until suddenly they weren't. When Kyung-hee Kim, a researcher at the College of William and Mary, analyzed the Torrance scores of more than 270,000 American children, she found that creative thinking had steadily declined since 1990, particularly among young children, the same group once found to be almost universally creative. The trend was so striking that Kim gave it a name, the creativity crisis. Though her research stopped short of pinpointing a cause, Kim has her suspicions, a tendency to jam-pack children's schedules with homework and structured activities, an over-reliance on standardized testing, cuts to electives and art classes, and the several hours per day that kids of all ages spend in front of their screens. Whatever the culprit, the problem remains the same. The fewer improvements kids make to toy trucks today, the fewer breakthroughs we can count on tomorrow. And oh, do we need breakthroughs? Consider the problems today's kids face: climate change, systemic racism, widening inequity, hunger, water shortages, disinformation campaigns, healthcare costs, and global instability, just to name a few. Each of these problems is multifaceted, beyond the grasp of any one person or field. Solving them will require collaboration, communication, and all of the other tools that Rogers taught. Above all, it will require creativity, the ability to generate new ideas and synthesize existing ones. In their book, Becoming Brilliant: What Science Tells Us About Raising Successful Children, psychologists Roberta Mitnick-Golenkoff and Kathy Hirsch-Pasek put it bluntly. How many different uses can you think of for a paper cup? They ask. Imagine your car is stuck on the ice. Can you think to put a board under the back wheels to give it tractions? And these are just the day-to-day problems we face. How will society meet the challenges of climate change and poverty without creativity? That's not all. Yes, creative kids become successful adults, and yes, there are countless economic and moral reasons to care about creativity. But even more importantly, creative pursuits scratch an existential itch, helping us voice the joys and hopes and disappointments that define our time on Earth. Novelist Kurt Vonnegut, a sort of philosophical twin to Rogers, said it best. Creativity and the arts, he wrote, are not a way to make a living. They are a very human way of making life more bearable. Practicing an art, no matter how well or badly, is a way to make your soul grow, for heaven's sake. Sing in the shower, dance to the radio, tell stories, write a poem to a friend, even a lousy poem. Do it as well as you possibly can. You will get an enormous reward. You will have created something. While creative thinking may be in decline, it doesn't have to be. Like curiosity, children's creativity can be nurtured and sustained. It can be kept front and center in their lives. It just takes some help from creative adults. And there are plenty of places where kids are able to find them. Amid the book stacks and computer tables in Pittsburgh's Carnegie Library, an oblate hive-like structure about the size of a school bus rises from the floor. At first glance, this room within a room looks like a collection of things confiscated, a librarian's nightmare of electric guitars, amplifiers, microphones, TVs, and a whirring 3D printer that's constructing at this moment a set of monster claws to be worn as part of a costume. Stepping into the structure, a monument to noise, electronics, and imagination, feels like leaving the library around it altogether. This is the Labs, a dedicated space for teenage creativity. The goal, says teen librarian Simon Rafferty, is to show kids that the library isn't what they think, that it's actually a fun, cool place to be. Judging by the dozens of kids who stream through the doors each afternoon after school, fun and cool might be understating things. In and around the Labs are top-of-the-line game consoles, a drum set, DSLR cameras, computers equipped with Photoshop and iMovie, and even a fully enclosed, self-contained recording studio, all for use by any kid at any time at zero cost. Regardless of a teen's interests or grades or family income, and in this part of Pittsburgh, family incomes are modest at most, the Labs exist to meet his or her creative needs. When teens come to the Labs, there's no set schedule, no homework, no pressure. Some kids come just for the recording studio, and that's fine. Others want to dabble in a little bit of everything, playing the instruments, using the sewing machines, and trying their hand at photography. Because we're different from, say, a school where kids are a captive audience, kids have to want to come to our space and want to use our equipment and want to be creative, says Rafferty. And so we have to give them lots of choices and lots of freedom because that's what kids get, especially older kids in the door. Our job is to give them the space and equipment they need to pursue their interests, whatever those happen to be. Kristen Morgan is the lead librarian for digital learning. Her office, just upstairs from the Labs, looks a bit like a Hollywood warehouse, long shelves filled with robot parts, circuit boards, audiovisual equipment, and automatons, small tadpole-shaped synthesizers from Japan. One could conceivably build a set, film a movie, record its soundtrack, and print promotional posters using just what's in this room. In fact, half of Morgan's job is ensuring that teens of every background can access the tools they need to turn their ideas into reality. The other half is making sure that such access is meaningful and that, say, Morgan starts with building relationships. By getting to know the kids who come to the lab each day, the library's staff learn their interests and ideas as well as the best ways to develop them. Adults need to build trust by working with kids day in and day out, says Morgan. When adults do that, they can become a supportive critic, someone who can gently push kids forward. We want them to exceed anyone's expectations and achieve amazing things, right? Well, that requires someone who's willing and able to guide kids and be an advocate for them in their work. To that end, she and Rafferty, along with a host of teaching artists, take both low and high touch approaches towards working with teens. Kids are welcome to experiment with most of the library's equipment on their own. If they want to learn a specific skill, the Labs also offer drop-in workshops and formal, loosely structured classes through which kids can earn a badge, a credential certifying their proficiency in, say, audio recording or beat making. Badges give kids even more equipment privileges. And for kids who want to level up even further, the Labs offer week-long summer intensives focused on everything from street art to filmmaking to photography. None of this, says Morgan, will work without relationships. It's one thing to open your doors and say to kids, hey, we have all these tools that can help you be creative, she says. It's another to get to know them on a level that lets you say, we're hosting this class next week or next month, and here's why I think you'd be a good fit for it and why I want you to be a part of it. Kids really crave that. When you honor their efforts, you validate their creativity, and you show them that they belong. Rafferty remembers a sixth grader who came to the Labs and discovered graphic design for the first time. He started playing around with the library's equipment and he really got into it, he says. He learned every tool, every method, every application he could. When he got to high school, he even arranged his classes so he could dig deeper into it, and then it became a career for him. By providing equipment, mentorship, and a path forward towards further learning, the Labs helped that kid discover himself in a small way, Rafferty says. He pauses for a moment and reconsiders. Maybe in a big way. Creativity starts with a spoon. Creativity is one part doing, dabbling, seeking help, and deepening one's understanding of an art or a science. But what about those ideas we get when we're not even trying? When we're walking the dog, maybe, or zoned out on the highway? Isn't there something to be said for the muses, for inspiration? Yes and no. Think of it this way. Unless you're a physicist on par with Albert Einstein, a grand theory of quantum mechanics isn't suddenly going to strike you. Likewise, unless you're a trained composer, that tune you found yourself humming will likely fall short of Beethoven's Fifth. And while it's true that outsiders can sometimes disrupt a field, that biologists solve physics problems and cellists write great books, there's almost always some overlap. Biologists and physicists are both trained to do science. Musicians and authors are both trained to tell stories. Creativity is almost wholly dependent on knowledge and experience. There's simply no getting around it. Hence the platitudes you've heard all your life. Genius is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. Chance favors the prepared mind, and so on. That's why when Rogers kicks off a 5-part series on creativity and make-believe, he does it with something simple, something every child can access. What is it that you like to eat your food with? He asks, lifting an imaginary spoon to his mouth. Rather than leading with something whimsical, something fantastic, or something that breaks all the rules, Rogers starts with, of all things, a kitchen utensil. Right away, he sets the stage for a universal truth. To be creative, it helps to grasp the basics. No one paints a masterpiece without first studying color. No one, not even Mozart, writes a concerto without first knowing some chords. And no one makes a beautiful spoon without knowing what a spoon is and how it might be used. The grunt work of building a knowledge base on which creative ideas can stand is almost always hidden from view and thus always forgotten. When we watch a movie, we only see the final cut. We're spared the dozen takes of a single scene, the cinematographer learning to hold a camera, the screenwriter spending weeks on just the right punchline. The best creative works belly the labor that goes into them, making it easy to think they simply arrived in the world fully formed and without effort. Rogers stops this myth in its track. Fred wanted children to know that things happen in a process, said Hedda Scherepan. It takes this step and that step. He wanted children to understand that a lot of things have to happen to create something. And we want to applaud the workers to show his young viewers that the people who make things are important people in our world. Within the first few minutes of Make Believe, for example, he takes us behind the scenes of a spoon factory, where he lays bare the creative process in its slow, painstaking entirety. A spoon maker first draws a picture of his intended product. Then he makes a model, slowly chipping away at a chunk of metal until it starts to resemble the idea in his head. Then he churns out prototypes, which are cleaned and polished and tinkered with until they're made exactly right. The segment's final shot, a slow pan over dozens of shiny spoons, reveals a product born of deliberate effort rather than divine inspiration. Anyone, Rogers explains, can make a beautiful spoon. Anyone can be creative. It just takes some work. It's a message he revisits again and again, using everything from spoons to paintings to clocks to make his point. When there's an opera in the neighborhood, it never happens in a void. Kids always see the planning and preparation and rehearsals required to stage it. Likewise, at the end of a sequence about a factory or farm, writes William Guy, a Pittsburgh-based author, Rogers points out that there's nothing magical about what it produces. The product, he notes, results from an idea that arose in a human mind, an idea that human beings carried out, something his viewers might do in the future. In other words, Rogers showed kids that creative dreams are attainable. He shows them that their mud pies and block buildings really do have value, not just for their own sake, but for the gourmet meals and soaring-sized skyscrapers they suggest. And he shows them the hidden perspiration it takes to bring one ideas into the world. When wasting time can be worth it. As soon as the spoon segment ends, Rogers gets a phone call. His friend was scheduled to stop by, he says, but she got held up. So now we'll have to wait. We'll have to sit here for a while with nothing much to do. We'll have to get a little bored. It's a prospect that strikes terror in all of us. Boredom is a beast we'll do most anything to slay. And over the years, we've gotten pretty good at it. It's possible in today's world of abundant tech and unlimited content to go days or weeks or longer without ever feeling understimulated. The smartphone alone has turned every mundane task into something else entirely. On an elevator, check your email. Waiting in line, time for Twitter. Walking the dog, fire up that dog walking playlist and check your daily step count. We've created an always-on, maximize-every-moment world, and now we're raising our kids in it. It's gotten so intense, writes David Epstein, author of Range, Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World, that in online forums, anxious parents agonize over what instrument to pick for a child because she is too young to pick for herself and will fall irredeemably behind if she waits. No wonder just one in five parents thinks it's good for kids to get bored once in a while. How can we possibly justify boredom when there are exams to ace, pianos to play, and paychecks to earn? It's important to know when we need to stop, reflect, and receive, Rogers once wrote. In our competitive world, that might be called a waste of time. However, I've learned that those times can be the preamble to periods of enormous growth. Recently, I declared a day to be alone with myself. I took a long drive and played a tape. When I got to the mountains, I read and prayed and listened and slept. In fact, I can't remember a calmer sleep in a long, long time. The next day, I went back to work and did more than I usually get done in 3 days. Wasting time, in other words, isn't always a waste of time. On the contrary, sometimes it's the most productive thing we can do. Let's imagine, for no particular reason, that you're writing a book about Fred Rogers and the tools for learning. You're in the midst of the creative chapter and things are going well. You've got your research in front of you, you've written your outline, and you have a pretty good idea of what you want to say and how you want to say it. But then, in the middle of a paragraph, it happens. You hit the wall, you get stuck. You know you need an example here, one that illustrates your point and tees up the next section, but nothing comes. You stare at the cursor and you force your hands to the keyboard. You type a few words and delete them. An hour goes by to, you're on a deadline, damn it. You don't have time for this. Why is writing so easy for everyone else, yet so difficult for you? You pound your forehead and pour a cup of coffee. You consider crying, but don't. Finally, resigned to failure, you give up and go for a walk. It's only after several miles, after you've walked far enough to forget about your problem and to stop thinking so much, that inspiration finally hits. Suddenly, it seems so simple, you can't believe you didn't think of it before. You rush home to type your clever meta example, overwhelmed with relief and silently thanking your brain. Congratulations, you've just discovered your default mode, the network of interconnected brain structures where the muse lives. The default mode network is where we go when we're truly, truly bored, so bored that we jump the rails of conscious thought and let our minds wander where they will. It's where, after we've put in our 99% perspiration, we can stop racking our brains and listen instead for inspiration. Now, neuroscientists know that the default mode is when you do your best original thinking, says Manoush Zomorodi, author of Bored and Brilliant, How Spacing Out Can Unlock Your Most Productive and Creative Self. It's where you do your problem solving. It's where you have imagination, where you have empathy. If we've done enough work, our default mode networks are there for us, ready to gift us creative ideas as long as we're willing to shut up and listen. The irony, of course, is that we do everything we can to drown ourselves out. It's not a new problem. A century ago, sociologists were already warning city dwellers about the dangers of constant stimulation, recommending extraordinary radical boredom for would-be creatives. Today, as adults and kids alike fill downtime with structured activities, binge-worthy TV shows, and the infinite expanse of the internet, they visit their default mode networks less and less frequently. No wonder more than 70% of people have their best ideas in the shower. It's one of the few remaining places where we leave our brains alone. Water and creativity, by the way, go way back. perhaps because water quiets our mind. Rogers himself made a point of swimming every morning, even when he was traveling. Swimming, says Maxwell King, was a period of meditation for him. It was a period in which he could just get away from organized thinking and let his creativity flow. In the summers, when he'd go up to Nantucket, he'd swim across the Matacor Harbor and then walk back to his house. He used to talk about how much he loved to do that because swimming and walking gave him a chance to be contemplative. He'd have a lot of his ideas that way. Rogers wasn't alone. Albert Einstein was known to stare at the sea for hours. Maya Angelou considered a midday shower essential to her work. And then there's the Japanese inventor, Yoshiro Nakamatsu, a man famous for taking this just a little too far. Nakamatsu submerges himself in a pool to starve his brain of oxygen, remaining underwater until he's just seconds from drowning, at which point he jots his ideas on a waterproof notepad. And though it's true that Nakamatsu invented the floppy disk and it's true that he holds 3,000 other patents, his process isn't exactly foolproof. Nakamatsu's more questionable claims to fame include spring-loaded shoes, a weighted wig that can be swung in self-defense, and Love Jet 69, an elixir designed to raise the Japanese birth rate. The upshot is that boredom, or perhaps more accurately, a period of mental quiet, contributes to creativity in a big way. When a child has nothing to do and must fill the time, creativity can emerge, writes Gollenkopf and Hirsch Pasek in Becoming Brilliant. It can be right there in a file drawer or a kitchen cupboard or in those shiny new markers lying on the table. This, of course, is what Rogers was telling us each time he sang, "Let's think of something to do," a neighborhood staple that appears for the first time when Rogers' friend gets delayed. Let's think of something to do while we're waiting for something new to do. Let's try to think up a song while we're waiting that's liberating and will be true to you. Let's think of something to do while we're waiting till something's through. You know, it's really all right. In fact, it's downright quite bright to think of something to do that's specific for you. Let's think of something to do while we're waiting. In addition to making kids feel better about boredom, the song also hints at something else. Its insistence on something liberating and true to and specific for you reflects what learning scientists have been saying all along. When we attempt to foster children's creativity, Vygotsky wrote, we need to observe the principle of freedom. This means that the creative activities of children cannot be compulsory or forced and must arise out of their own interests. Creativity, it turns out, can't be imposed. But in the right environment, in spaces where kids feel safe, relaxed, and free to follow their interests, creativity can be encouraged, and no one created those environments quite like Rogers. Everywhere you look here, there's something beautiful looking back. Rogers designed every aspect of the neighborhood to buoy the creative impulse. Take, for example, his TV wardrobe, a compendium of sweaters and shoes intended to put viewers at ease. Rogers emitted an aura of safety and relaxation that's essential to creativity. When kids feel rushed or intimidated or judged, experts say, or when they don't trust their surroundings, it can be difficult for them to think through their own stress. Accordingly, Rogers slowed the neighborhood to a deliberate, almost crawl pace. Each episode begins with a rush of piano notes, which decrescendo over the next few measures into the theme song, sounds like a lullaby. As he enters the set, Rogers ditches the suit and tie uniform of the fast-paced working world. The traffic light in his living room signals yellow, telling us it's time to slow down. And the unhurried scenes that follow are almost sedating in their warmth and radical calm. In one episode, there's a minute-long close-up of an egg timer. In another, there are several shots of Rogers watching paint dry. I remember when we did a segment at an art museum and Fred spent time, almost the whole time, looking at one painting, says Bill Eisler, the longtime president of Rogers production company, Family Communications, which later became Fred Rogers Productions. The museum staff wanted him to feature some more, but he said, "I want children to be able to slow down and focus so they can see all the little details and the things this person has created." Even the neighborhood's color scheme seemed optimized for mental peace. The color blue, for example, was linked by one study to an increase in creative output, possibly because we associate it with the sea and the sky and thus find it calming. And where is Rogers as he schools us on creativity? In his very blue living room, wearing a blue sweater, a blue tie, and blue shoes. He also made a point of always cleaning up, says Hedda Scherepan. When he was working with crayons or paper or anything else, the last part of the sequence was always putting things back together or putting them back in the cupboard. That helps children know that cleaning up is part of the creative process, too. You come back to an environment that's clean and inviting. Indeed, environment matters. In 2002, Janetta McCoy of Washington State University tested the creative performance of high school students in two settings, one rich in wood and soaked in sunlight, and the other comprised of sterile manufactured materials like plastic and drywall. Though the task was the same in both environments, kids in the former setting churned out more imaginative work, suggesting that natural-seeming spaces can aid creative thought. Of course, rich in wood and soaked in sunlight sounds an awful lot like Roger's living room, his home base in the neighborhood, full of beautiful, bright, well-made things. It could also describe the Manchester Craftsmen's Guild, one of the most remarkable community art centers on the planet. Located in Pittsburgh's North Side neighborhood, the Guild's lobby alone contains colorful story cloths from the city's Hmong community, exquisite Japanese benches built by a famous furniture maker, more orchids and artwork than one could count, and even a kitchen that serves gourmet food, and only gourmet food, its chefs will tell you. The building itself, all glass plants and parallel lines, recalls the work of Frank Lloyd Wright, whose homes looked so in tune with nature that they seem to sprout from the forest floor. It looks, you might say, like an artist's retreat, a place where the leisure class might want to unwind for a few days among world-class art and a world-class building with world-class food. And that's exactly the vibe that its founder, Bill Strickland, was going for, with one exception. He built the Guild not for the ultra-rich, but for the kids in Pittsburgh's underserved neighborhoods. Most of the young people we see come from environments where fear is the predominant emotion, fear of failure, of violence, of economic hardship, he says. They're surrounded by negativity. In my view, that's the worst part of being poor, what it does to your spirit. It's a feeling he knows firsthand. By his own account, Strickland's dreams have been dampened by the same structures and forces that surround his students today. He lives in the same neighborhood, went to the same under-resourced schools, and bumped up against the same societal barriers. As an adolescent, he says, he was aimless, apathetic, and not a particular Particularly hopeful about any sort of future. Until one day, a high school pottery teacher invited him to shape some clay, an experience that completely changed his sense of self. All of a sudden, I felt like I had a purpose, Strickland recalls. I started going to that room every day, first thing in the morning. I was a black kid who didn't know anything about pottery, but I felt for the first time like I had a creative side, that I could build something worthwhile. Pottery was just the beginning. In that class, Strickland discovered an entire creative world. His teacher brought albums by Herbie Hancock and other giants of jazz. He brought books that kids actually wanted to read. He brought fine art. And he took students to see Falling Water, Frank Lloyd Wright's masterpiece. I was blown away by that place, Strickland recalls. Here was a house that was tranquil and peaceful and aesthetically tied to nature. It was exactly the kind of environment a kid like me needed, yet never got to see. So I said, someday I'm going to build a school just like that. In 1968, the same year Mr. Rogers debuted, Strickland found a dilapidated row house in Pittsburgh, Manchester neighborhood. Living out of a sleeping bag, he installed a kiln and cleaned the place out. He had few resources and little experience, he recounts in his memoir, but he knew what young people needed. A safe, sane, quiet environment where they could escape the madness that reigned in the streets, work on some clay, and find a way to shape something personal and beautiful, and spend some time in a bright, clean, nurturing place where it did not seem pointless to dream. In Manchester's Craftsman Guild was born. It wasn't falling water, but it would do. As kids came in from the street, Strickland saw in them the same changes he'd seen in himself. They started showing up for school more regularly. Their grades improved. In clay, they connected with math. In glaze, they connected with chemistry. In Strickland's bright, clean, creative environment, they found the tools to shape their dreams. Eventually, the guild attracted attention and funding. Throughout the 1980s, Strickland raised several million dollars to build the school he'd always wanted. He hired one of Frank Lloyd Wright's students to do the job, and the result was one of the most successful community arts centers ever built. Today, the Guild seats hundreds of kids each year and operates campuses around the world. A full 98% of its students graduate from high school on time, and 85% go on to college or some other sort of secondary education. Moreover, in 50 years of operation, the Guild has never had an incident involving violence or drugs, and they've never called the police. It's the same story elsewhere. At the Guild's locations in Israel, for example, Jews and Palestinians walk side by side to their art classes every day. Someone once asked me where the metal detectors were, said Strickland. I said, here we call them students. All of this comes down to the Guild's environment, he says. We literally created a space that says, we're into creativity 24/7 and you deserve to be here. And if you stick around long enough, you're going to start to believe that through absorption, if nothing else. Strickland walks through his office lined with nearly 30 honorary degrees and pictures of presidents and first ladies shaking his hand. He wanders the Guild's hallways, which double as sunlit art galleries. Everywhere you look here, there's something beautiful looking back, he explains. This is deliberate. Kids look at orchids, they feel sunlight, they eat gourmet food, and take pottery lessons from the best teachers in the world. Environments like this one erase fear. They cure cancer of the human spirit, and the kids inside them blossom. While Strickland learned creativity's life-changing power from his ceramics teacher, his lessons on building a positive, calm, creative environment came from a different role model altogether. He was kind, Strickland recalls. He was always kind, and he demonstrated by his life that no matter how you look or where you came from, you were a member of the neighborhood. That's the reason I built this place. I wanted to give kids that same feeling. I wanted to be Fred Rogers. Rogers himself thought the same about Strickland, featuring the Guild on the neighborhood more than once. In one episode in the early 1990s, Rogers brings viewers to the Guild ceramic studio where he and Strickland conduct a masterclass on creativity. They start with raw clay and slowly learn to shape it. They discuss the importance of practice and patience, and they show viewers what the final product can look like, noting that children too can make beautiful things. At the end of the segment, Rogers muses about Strickland's talents. My friend Bill is a good teacher, he says. He uses clay so well because he's been working on it for so long. But creativity, Rogers adds, is more than just work. The drive to create in the first place comes from a much deeper impulse. Strickland didn't do fancy things with clay when he was a little boy, Rogers explains. He just loved to play with it and make things, anything that he could. That's how it all began with him, playing with mud and with clay. And now look at the things he can make. Better to make a cape than buy a costume. Freddie Rogers, too, was a boy who loved to play. Born March 20, 1928, in La Trobe, Rogers grew up wealthy during the height of the Great Depression. But the wealth came at a cost. His father's Celica brick business earned a fortune lining the insides of factories, and Rogers, like lots of kids in western Pennsylvania, had more than his share of health problems. The soot-induced asthma that plagued the region often kept him indoors, especially during the warmer months. He sometimes spent whole summers in his room with nothing but puppets and a piano for company. So Rogers did what any kid would do. He played. He made up songs, he pretended, he imagined other worlds and populated them with his puppet friends. Through play, Rogers expressed and expanded his existence, discovering the creative talents and passions that would one day turn a lonely little boy into the world's most beloved neighbor. Though his family's wealth made him an outlier, Roger's path from playful kid to creative adult is surprisingly well-trodden. Bill Strickland walked it, despite growing up in poverty. So have kids of every background and circumstance who've grown up to be artists, scientists, and entrepreneurs. And often, researchers think their common thread is play. Open-ended, imaginative play is crucial to creativity, or as psychologists Dorothy and Jerome Singer call it, a willingness to explore the possible. In their book, The House of Make-Believe, the Singers identify the essential ingredients of that willingness. An adult who inspires encourages and joins in children's play, a dedicated sacred space for play, unstructured free time, and simple objects that enrich the imagination. Rogers had these ingredients in droves. Lots of people encouraged his creativity, says Maxwell King. Certainly his grandfather did, and his mother did too. The fact that he was given a lot of encouragement to develop his capacities as a musician really helped him understand the things that mattered to him. Over the past few decades, however, play has grown increasingly absent from children's lives. Busy lifestyles and an emphasis on academics have muscled playtime out of family and school routines. When kids do have time to play, they increasingly do so on electronic devices, which, though not inherently negative, aren't always as open-ended as puppets or a hulk of clay. In fact, by 2018, playtime's decline had become so severe the American Academy of Pediatrics released a prescription for the nation's parents. Play with your child every day. Play is not frivolous, the doctors declared. Play is fundamentally important for building 21st century skills such as problem solving, collaboration, and creativity, skills that are critical for adult success. Rogers, of course, knew this all along. Play was the subject of a lot of debate in the 70s and 80s when Rogers was making The Neighborhood, says King. A lot of people just wanted kids to immediately apply themselves to learning numbers and language, to cognitive learning in a very organized way. But Rogers was a great proponent of free play and creativity, not just because he wanted to give kids a chance to have fun, but because he recognized that it was essential to children's learning and to the development of their capacities for learning. Roberta Schomburg agrees. We knew that children start to develop initiative between 3 and 5 years old, she says. That's why he focused so much on creativity, because initiative emerges if children are given some control over the ways they play, the materials they use, and what the final outcome is. Lots of parents and teachers were focused on having children follow their patterns for making things and for playing a certain way. So what Fred was doing was fostering creativity and a sense of initiative by modeling something different and valuing the child's ideas. Hence his daily invitations to the neighborhood of make-believe, a bright, colorful play world where people, things, and ideas from everyday life can be customized and modified at will. It's a place where anything's possible, where a tiger can live in a clock and purple pandas can ping to other planets. And it's where, at the beginning of Make-Believe Week, we find Lady Aberlin and King Friday the 13th mixing pretend tea with real spoons. Spoons, the king, and Lady Aberlin, let's make it up together. The story expands as quickly as a five-year-old's mind. Over a warm cup of imaginary tea, King Friday the 13th suddenly has an idea. Once, on the side of a mountain, he says, he had a lovely cup of real tea, and wouldn't it be fun to do that again, to have a tea party on a very tall mountain beside his castle? Of course, there aren't any mountains in make-believe, but in play worlds like this one, reality, let alone the complex geophysics of tectonic shift, need not apply. And so the king makes up his mind. I, King Friday the 13th, command you both to make a mountain right beside the castle here in make-believe, he declares. I'm sure you'll find a way. Lady Aberlin and her friend, Robert Troll, think for a moment about the task they've been assigned. People can't make mountains. Everyone knows that. But because they're playing, the characters don't dismiss it as impossible. Instead, they generate ideas, seek help from their friends, and even distract themselves when the thinking hits a wall. I think we should sing a song, Aberline suggests. That's a good idea. Take our minds off it, says Troll. Through play, in other words, make-believe's characters leverage divergent thinking, convergent thinking, and even the brain's default mode thinking. They seek creative collaborators who help them think differently about their problem, and crucially, they're unburdened by self-censorship. And make-believe, there's no idea too strange, too nonsensical, or too implausible to consider. Eventually, Lady Aberlin and Robert Troll devise a potential solution. Though there aren't any mountains in make-believe, there is an Eiffel Tower, and by covering it with trees that they've dug up with special spoons, they might fulfill King Friday's command. This, of course, leads to several more adventures until Make Believe Week culminates in a full-blown opera, one titled, appropriately, Spoon Mountain. That's the power of play. Something simple becomes something more. A spoon becomes a mixer for pretend tea, a shovel for transferring trees, an inspiration for an opera. Play is the seed from which creativity sprouts. You see a child play, and it is so close to seeing an artist paint, for in play, a child says things without uttering a word, says Erik Erikson. So how do we encourage more of it? For starters, we can do what Rogers did and take play seriously. That is, we can treat children's mud pies, block buildings, and made-up games and stories with respect, no matter how absurd they seem to adults. We can assign play the importance it deserves by restoring unstructured free time to children's schedules. Though modern parents might understandably balk at playtime when there are spelling words to memorize and math problems to solve, play can be every bit as effective as schoolwork, sometimes even more so. Play is often talked about as if it were a relief from serious learning, Rogers once said, but for children, play is serious learning. We can also give kids their sacred space, whether it's a corner of the kitchen table or a section of the backyard. My mother let me build a pottery shop in the basement of our funky little row house, Bill Strickland recalls. And then I took over the laundry room and made it a photography studio. I didn't have much, but I did have a caring mother who said, "My kid is on fire. I'll wash clothes somewhere else. Leave the kid alone." Without that, you don't grow up to build buildings. Finally, to the extent that we're able, we can give kids access to simple objects that propel their play. Mud pies and block buildings will work just fine. Just ask Jane Werner, executive director of the Children's Museum of Pittsburgh, America's largest cultural campus for kids. Housed in an ancient post office, a once abandoned library, and a former planetarium, the museum includes vats of mud, towers of wood blocks, a real car for kids to play in, a climbing gym made of packing tape, 50 miles of it, and in its makerspace, soldering irons, sewing machines, and table saws. All of this, says Werner, reflects the museum's approach to creativity. Let kids play with real stuff. Kids have imagination, she explained, wading through a sea of first graders. They don't need manufactured fun. They don't need plastic. They don't need fake trees or fake logs or fake animals. Instead, she says, creativity comes from the stuff of real life, from playing with real materials and using real tools and making real things. It's a philosophy she learned from Rogers himself, with whom Werner spent countless hours designing exhibits, many of which are on tour around the country. One of them, How People Make Things, spotlights the craft of making spoons. He was always pushing us to remember what it was like to be a kid, she said. He'd say, I don't need to tell you what's right for children. Somewhere inside, you know what's right for children because you were a child yourself. When Werner and her team considered that their own childhoods, she says, their standout moments always revolved around real stuff, playing in creeks, staging shows, and painting pretty pictures. No one had discovered his or her talents by watching TV or playing with plastic toys. That's what Fred has been telling us all along, said Werner, and that's what the Children's Museum tries to reflect. To that end, the museum puts power tools and paintbrushes in visitors' hands, real things that expand children's understanding of their own capabilities. We had a kid come in recently who decided he wanted to make a sign for his wiffle ball field, she says. We taught him how to use a table saw. He cut the wood for the sign, then cut the words into it with a laser cutter. Now he wants to make all sorts of things. When kids can act on their ideas, they tend to have another idea, and another, and another. Likewise, when kids build with the museum's blocks or use its laser cutters for the first time, they begin to think, I am capable, I am confident, I am creative. Real materials and real tools help them bring their ideas to life and question their models of the world. Block building becomes prototypes. Doodles become first draft. Werner sums it up like this. It's better to make a cape than to buy a costume. To kids, a piece of fabric can become anything. Research suggests that she's right. Open-ended toys like blocks and dollhouses tend to produce more imaginative kids than manufactured toys with only one use. In the 1980s, psychologists Deborah Pepler and Hildy Ross gave toddlers a set of toys that could be used as either a puzzle by fitting the pieces into a foam board or a freestanding blocks. Then they split the kids into two groups. One group got the toys and the former board, and the form board, the others only got the toys. After giving the kids some play time to play, Pepler and Ross tested each group's problem-solving abilities. They found that the kids without form boards, that is, the kids who'd had to develop their own use for the toys, came up with more creative solutions than the peers who played with a predefined puzzle. That's why Rogers deployed simple objects like spoons in the neighborhood. A spoon allows you to bring whatever you are to it, says Hedda Sharapan. Maybe you use it to feed your baby doll. Maybe you make a drum noise with it, or you use it to scoop up some sand. Unfortunately, most commercial toys are a one-trick pony. We want children to be able to do things that are of their own making. That's what creativity is. What are your ideas? What would you do? Your ideas matter. At the Children's Museum, Werner sees this every day. Kids walk into this space and think, I can do anything here, she says. And that's empowering. That's where creativity comes from. New uses for old things. Suddenly, there's a knock on Roger's door, and there stands Mary Alice Scherer, his long-delayed friend. She's finally here. Already today, we've seen several types of spoon, watch a film about how spoons get made, and made up a spoon story in the neighborhood of make-believe. Now, Sherrod's here to deliver the final, most important spoon point. Should I get you some spoons? Rogers asks, leaning in expectantly. No, says Sherrod, I carry my own faithful, my old faithfuls with me. She pulls two tablespoons from her pantsuit pocket and holds them back to back. She slaps the spoons against her hand, taps them on her knee, and claps them together. She makes music with those spoons, manic, beautiful, joyful music. And in doing so, she shows kids why creativity matters. Mary Alice Sherrod has found a new use for an old thing. Creativity, scientists say, is about more than drawing pictures or shaping pots or making spoons. It's about putting boards under spinning tires, turning paper cups into telephones, and one day meeting the challenges of climate change and poverty. It's about taking the knowledge and ideas and feelings that exist in the world already and making them more useful to ourselves and our neighbors. Isn't that what we need to encourage everywhere? Rogers asks, in constant reference to the traditional new solutions to old problems? Indeed, which brings us back to one of the oldest problems at all, the fact that so many of us stop drawing, stop painting, and stop inventing stories. The fact that so many of us set down our instruments and let our music go quiet. For more than a century, scientists like George Land have warned that the world and its pressures can crush creativity if we let it. But they've also assured us that our inner creativity never truly disappears and that it's still in there somewhere waiting for us to wake up. Maybe it's time we try. Though picking up a paintbrush or sitting down at a Steinway might seem painful after years or even decades-long creative drought, doing so brings immediate benefits, scientists say. Adults who do something creative at least once a day have been found to be happier and healthier than their peers, an effect that sometimes lasts for days. Vonnegut was right. Creating something, even when it's lousy, confers an enormous reward. But more importantly, it models for children that creativity isn't just for kids, that even with their busy schedules and jangled nerves, adults paint portraits and shape clay and make up stories too. It shows kids they don't have to give up their mud pies or block buildings or even when the world seems to scoff at them. And it shows them that the point of painting and drawing isn't to make masterpieces or to be the best at something, but rather to make our souls grow, to become more fully ourselves. The best way to raise creative kids may be to show them that we, as adults, value creativity too. Scientists have found that imaginative kids are more likely to have imaginative parents, people who consider themselves adventurous and open-minded. This holds true even beyond the fourth grade slump. Creative older kids are more likely to say their parents told them stories or engaged in make-believe with them. In fact, parents' emphasis on imaginativeness can predict their children's creativity even years down the road. It's not just parents. Exposure to any creative adult can be helpful. Art museums, school exhibits, community art centers exhibits all show that real people draw and express themselves creatively, write Gollenkopf and Hirsch Pasek. That's why the neighborhood's regulars all make a point of showing off their skills. There's Officer Clemens, the opera singer, Bob Tro, the builder and portrait painter, Audrey Roth, the business owner and needlepoint expert, and Joe Negri, the handyman and gifted guitarist. These characters are everyday adults, people whose creative endeavors enrich not only their lives, but also the lives of the people around them. And that's not meant not to mention the neighborhood's creative guest stars, from Yo-Yo Ma the cellist to Bill Strickland the potter to Mary Sherrod the spoon player. Finally, there's also Rogers himself, the otherwise ordinary man at the heart of it all, who sings, paints, makes up stories, and sees the limitless potential in real stuff like spoons. Even when Roger sits there folding a paper fan out of construction paper or using safety scissors to cut out something, he acts like he's doing something for himself, as well as the viewer, notes the television critic David Bianculli, as though on a rainy day he might amuse himself the same way, even if there were no cameras to record his actions. What a way to live a richer life. The spoon concert ends, Mary Sherrod departs, and we're left with Rogers in his blue sweater and his blue shirt and his blue living room. Well, he says, good memories with spoons, and then he sings his farewell. He swaps his sweater for the suit and tie and he walked in with. The music speeds up until it feels almost frantic, and it's clearly time to go back to the fast-moving pace past the famous front door, back to the world that's sometimes scary or mean or lonely or sad, back to the world where make-believe ends and a spoon is just a spoon. But as Rogers gets ready to leave, he departs ever so slightly from his same old goodbye, the sing smile wave routine that we've seen so many times. Today he does something different. He grabs a fistful of spoons on his way out the door. He bangs them together and looks back at the camera. He grins as if he's pulled off a heist, and maybe he has, because as Rogers leaves the set, it's clear he's managed to keep something that so many others have lost. And he's shown us in his own creative way that we can keep it too. What might you do? Schedule what now time. Put aside the phones, turn off the TV, and ask, what can we do together during these next 30 minutes? Explore what's in your cupboards or out in the yard and create something new. Maybe a silly game, maybe a pillow fort, or some other make-believe structure. Or do something you haven't done before and show us what you end up doing using this hashtag, when you wonder. Environment drives behavior. That's a core lesson from both the Manchester Craftsman's Guild and the Children's Museum of Pittsburgh. Whenever and wherever possible, give children the support and the space to ask, what might I do here with these things? Adults can do this too. I've been in professional development where educators pass around a paper towel tube and say, what could this be? Says Hedda Scherapin. That helped us remember that that's how children think. What could this be? Set aside a corner in your basement, classroom, or library as a maker space. Fill it with knickknacks from around the house or from a thrift store or a yard sale. Make time for your own creative self, whether you've picked up an old hobby or learning a new one. When was the last time you dabbled in art, painting, or drawing, or music, or photography? Ask Gollenkopf and Hirsch Pasek and Becoming Brilliant. We are often so afraid that we are not good enough that we don't even try. Who cares if our attempt at drawing that apple looks more like unidentifiable scribbles on a page? Let your kids see you try something that once captured your own interests. Greg recently pulled out his old skate board and he made it down the street without a single bump or bruise. Six kids on the street now have their own boards. Your own creativity could inspire your kids to try something new.